Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental. I'm Andrew Wiebe from my apartment in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, joined by my partner in soccer, Kaylin Carr, who, as well as co-hosting Extra Time, is the host, the producer, the end-all be-all of the movement, what I think is the best storytelling in the Major League Soccer universe, and I take that back, the North American Soccer universe. Kaylin, people might have seen on their feeds something a little new, the movement, the podcast. Explain what they're going to get into as we give them a little taste of what's to come.
Thanks, Weebs. I mean, this episode is all about the Black Players for Change organization and a continuation of a lot of the conversations we've had on this show over the last months around the Black Lives Matter movement and how soccer intersects with that and has responded. So it really started with Ray Gaddis reaching out to me via DMs and saying, hey, I'm at the protest in my hometown of Indianapolis. What can we do to get this story out? And from there, it kept growing and growing, where I interviewed Jeremy Abobasi, Ike Opara, who else? Jeez, Atlanta United supporters, Warren Craval, who designed the podcast art, as well as Ethan White. So it's turned into a much longer story than we had expected, sadly, due to the continuation of racial injustice we've seen throughout this country over the last months. But it's been really inspiring to see what these players have done and how we can all support the BPC and what they want to do next.
I got the early screener of this. I begged you for it, basically. And I have to say, anybody who's listening right now, stick around. Listen to the full show. It's powerful. It's important. It'll educate you. It'll make you think. And of course, the production is top-notch. Between Kaylin and Nick Fershon, old Extra Time throwback, you know him well. His podcast, Paternal, is amazing, and he did a brilliant job on this with Kaylin's help to really produce something special for you. So we are giving you this taste on our channel, on the Extra Time feed, but of course, there is a movement feed as well. So go subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Listen wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that be iTunes or Spotify or Stitcher or somewhere else. You can also find a link to the podcast in the description of this show, and we'll also tweet it out, and all the updates are on Twitter as well, at Kaylin Carr. With that, take a listen. Enjoy, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow with the normal show.
Based on the award-winning video series, this is The Movement on North American Soccer Culture. I'm your host, Kaylin Carr. And for our first episode, we'll examine how the Black soccer community and the Black Lives Matter movement coincide in MLS. And how over 170 Black players, representing different countries, languages, religions, and cultures, have come together to form the Black Players for Change organization, the BPC.
For me, it started on Instagram, you know, via DMs.
This is Philadelphia Union midfielder Warren Craval.
Maybe like 8 at the time, voicing our frustrations mainly at corporations and specifically, you know, MLS, you know, not really speaking up on any of the injustices that were happening. That coupled with the actual acts of brutality that were happening and how that was affecting all of us, that group on Instagram began to grow and grow to a point where it maxed out the group, and some of the guys were like, all right, this needs to become something bigger.
Representatives of other teams are also now ringing the playing area.
On July 8th, 2020, just before the kickoff of the Orlando City and Inter Miami match, the first of the MLS's back tournament, these 170-plus Black players, representing different MLS clubs across the U.S. and Canada, walked out onto the field, one by one, to surround the two teams already on the pitch.
The message that Black Lives Matter has resonated around the world these past few weeks. In an MLS perspective, it's led to the formation of an organization called Black Players for Change, the aim to give Black players a voice, both within and beyond the league, and to press for systemic change.
As the Orlando City and Inter Miami players took a knee around the center circle, all of the Black players, alongside the Black coaches and Black executives in MLS, lined the outside of the field, and one by one, each raised a single Black glove fist and stood in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds in honor of George Floyd.
If the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis was the initial spur, The subsequent response has been both reassuring and, frankly, extraordinary.
Conversations around racial injustice have been growing in MLS, especially over the past 4 years, including some of the biggest names in MLS. This is BPC member and TFC striker Josie Altidore at our Black History Month roundtable in 2017.
White people love to tell you to get over it. Right. You know, stop grieving, stop complaining. It's like, oh, come on, we heard enough of that. Nah, you were hanging, burning, beating, raping Black people 500 years. When we ready to stop grieving, we gonna let you know.
This is BPC board member and Minnesota United defender Ike Opara in my trip to Minneapolis for an episode of The Movement there in the summer of 2019.
If I get pulled over, you know, by a cop, I don't say, I'm Ike Opara, soccer player, like, I'm good and safe. No, that's not, that's out the window. I go to the realm of, oh man, once you leave whatever sport you play, you are who you are in society.
And this is BPC board member and Portland Timbers striker, Jeremy Ibobasi.
You know, it's ironic for me in Disney. This is where one of the first times I was called the N-word on a field when I was 12. And so to be out there before the first game with a lot of people who had probably gone through the same experience, it was really emotional. And on the field where I felt, you know, the most vulnerable and alone, to be supported like that, that was real special.
The following morning, after the BPC's protest with all 170 players that night, the Philadelphia Union took the field for their first match of the MLS's back tournament versus New York City FC. When it was time for the customary team photo, the entire team took off their Black Lives Matter warm-up tops and revealed something different on the back of their kits.
This is interesting, John. Those are not the names of those players.
This is ESPN's Taylor Twellman when it happened.
For the Philadelphia Union, I'm going to do a little digging here, but that looks like the names of Black people that have either died from police inequality, when it looked like the players on the bottom of their jersey wrote one name too many.
I asked the Union's Warren Craval about that moment as well.
Taylor Twellman was kind of stumbling through, you know, what exactly was happening. You know, he admitted on air, you know, I'm going to have to do some research. And that was absolutely the intended purpose, to kind of shock and, you know, it prompts an action following. I think the timing couldn't have been better for, you know, us being the first game debuting the MLS's Black Solidarity Tops, to kind of that being the central attention point at that time, and then to take them off to kind of knock you upside the head with the next message. Any one of these names could have been us.
This is Warren's teammate on the Philadelphia Union, Ray Gaddis, and Portland Timber striker, Jeremy Ibobasi.
When I look in the mirror, I can easily see George Floyd or a Trayvon Martin.
The fact that in a moment, my life could be decided at a split second by the color of my skin.
What for? What did we do? Not even being funny now, are we gonna make it home? I mean, too often we hear and we watch people narrate their own death.
You know, Eric Garner, I can't breathe.
George Mann, Darius Stewart.
Tatiana Jefferson.
Tyree Crawford. Emmett Till, even coming way before us.
Sandra Bland.
India Kager.
Respectability politics kills us. It tells the wider public that unless we are Harvard grads, you know, with nice jobs and no record, there is a reason acceptable enough for us to be killed. And for some reason, the onus is always on the victim. Oh, he smoked weed. Oh, he had a couple robberies. You know, oh, he stole from 7-Eleven.
Michael Brown.
Oh, he looked intimidating. He was 6 feet.
Tamir Rice.
Or in Tamir Rice's case, he was 12 years old, but he looked like a man.
Laquan McDonald.
Laquan McDonald. I mean, 16 shots. That's unfathomable.
I can easily see these people as myself.
There's too many to name.
So, how did we get here? My hope here is to take you into some conversations with former teammates, competitors, and friends that you might not hear otherwise, but I promise you, have been happening in locker rooms for quite some time now. It's a chance to listen and learn from the experiences and stories of Black players and fans in different cities I've spent the past few months speaking with. all leading to this moment and movement of MLS player protest. And honestly, so much has changed in so little time, where even in the 4-month span of recording and producing this podcast, there's been seemingly one murder after the next. And we've been recording and re-recording interviews with these players throughout. Just when we thought we'd finish this, we learned that Jacob Blake, a father of three in Kenosha, Wisconsin, on August 23rd, was shot by police 7 times in the back, leading to a moment we surely couldn't have imagined when we started this project, before the BPC had even formed. Where in unison with their fellow MLS players of all races and in solidarity with the leadership shown by pro athletes in the NBA and WNBA, they made history and decided enough is enough. And the games, they stopped. George Floyd was born on October 14th, 1973 in North Carolina, but shortly after moved to Houston, Texas. The neighborhood he grew up in, called the Third Ward, is a place I was told not to turn into for fear of crime or violence as I drive home to my midtown apartment from the University of Houston's Robertson Stadium, where we used to play our matches for the Houston Dynamo. The Third Ward is probably best known as the home to Beyoncé and Solange, but it is also home to the poet Pat Parker, or country blues artist Lightnin' Hopkins. A place with a real depth of history in the arts and culture for the African-American community and the city of Houston itself. Now, while I was in Houston, Warren Cravall became a teammate and good friend of mine. He was selected by the Houston Dynamo in the second round of the 2012 MLS Super Draft. I had joined the Dynamo a year earlier, and we've continued to stay in close touch, most recently at his wedding where he married his now wife, Chelsea, who he met and is from Houston herself. I called Warren up recently while he was in Orlando to talk about everything that's been going on.
I guess just when you look back on your time in Houston, I know you still, your wife is from there, Chelsea, and you got married there. When you look back on Houston as a place, what place does that hold for you?
Really polarizing, if I'm being honest.
During preseason training in February 2012, before he'd even signed a contract with the team, Warren and some of my other teammates on the Dynamo went out for a night out on Houston's Washington Avenue, where most of the nightlife was at the time.
Going out on, you know, when we had the next day off and, you know, blown off steam with some of the guys, had a reservation somewhere, and we weren't allowed in because we had too many black people. And I think it's really easy to say that we know that's the reason, but when it's said directly to your white friend, you know, like, they weren't even trying to hide it. Like, no, this is the reason. And, you know, for myself, it was a situation where I knew where this night could go. Whereas, you know, my teammate, you know, at the time did what any good teammate would do and, you know, when, you know, stood up for, you know, his black teammates. Obviously, you know, fast forward, that ended up going really south, you know, with myself and him getting arrested.
After a scuffle broke out in the parking lot between one of the Dynamo players and an off-duty Houston police officer, our teammate, Tyler Derrick, was arrested for, quote, assaulting a public servant. And Warren was as well, accused of, quote, interfering with public duties.
This is one of my first weeks in Houston. This is really all I know about the city, so for that to be, you know, the introduction, you know, just a couple weeks in was really tough to get past, you know.
Warren was only 21 years old at the time, and whatever mistake the authorities thought he had made might have just cost him not just a roster spot with the Dynamo, but his dreams he'd worked so hard for of becoming a professional soccer player.
Sitting in a jail cell, you know, just thinking like, man, like, my chances are gone now, you know, now I'm just another statistic. And it was literally just because I was black. I was standing back watching this happen, videotaping, and was arrested for it.
And it's in! Warren Cravall has finally found the back of the net.
Warren's arrest ultimately didn't affect his career, and the case against him was dismissed. He spent 3 years in Houston with the Dynamo, another 2 in Toronto, and then the past six seasons with the Philadelphia Union, where he's been part of the leadership group in the Union locker room that decided to change the names on the back of their kits for their first match of the MLS's back tournament. Now think about that for a second. A guy who was arrested 8 years ago after he wasn't allowed in a nightclub for being black is now at the forefront of a movement to bring attention to the plight of black soccer players and people in this country overall. And the BPC asked Warren to design the Black Lives Matter solidarity tops that were worn throughout the tournament by all players and staff and are still being worn on sidelines and among supporters across the country today.
I'm really fortunate, you know, just to be sitting here talking to you, you know, 8 years later, you know, being able to continue playing.
Do you have the shirt around you?
Yeah, I got it in my room.
Can you read the passage, the sort of little text box that you added to it?
Yeah, so it reads, to be clear, this is not your distraction. It's not your escape from real life. For some, this is everyday life. It's not politics, it's not black versus white, it's human rights. Silence is violence. In certain cases, silence with suffocation. This is not meant for your comfort. It's not meant to be a trend. It's meant for your awareness, understanding, and mobilization. If you're not uncomfortable, you're doing it wrong. MLS is back, but black lives still matter. They mattered yesterday, they matter today, and they must matter tomorrow.
Floyd moved to Minneapolis in 2014 in search of a fresh start and found a position as a security guard at a Salvation Army downtown, later as a truck driver, and most recently as a bouncer at a local Latin club. And like many Americans, Floyd lost his job due to the COVID-19 crisis and then contracted the disease himself. On his final day, the police were called on Mr. Floyd for allegedly buying cigarettes using a counterfeit $20 bill. The following morning, Minneapolis PD's spokesperson John Elder's written statement had the subject line, quote, "Man dies after medical incident during police interaction." He went on to detail that the subject had, quote, "resisted arrest," which he hadn't, and that after he handcuffed him, he, quote, "appeared to be suffering medical distress." But it became painfully clear once the world saw a bystander video of the arrest that Floyd died after former Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin and aided by three other officers knelt on Mr. Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Floyd can be heard saying the words, "I can't breathe," at least 16 times in that span. Minnesota United defender Aiko Parra lives less than a mile away. I asked him what it was like being there throughout the many nights of protests and at the start, which in the days following the murder, Ike went to join in.
It was, you know, bone chilling. It was uncomfortable. It was angering because you could just picture step by step, you know, how it all happened. And the day before, I had actually seen, you know, his family, you know, give a speech there, and his brother was crying at the site. And I felt every single tear that he gave when I was at that site.
I understand y'all upset. Like it was already said, I doubt y'all half as upset as I am.
It was tough, for sure.
Aiko Parra has been in MLS for 11 seasons. He joined Minnesota United in 2019 and promptly won the Defender of the Year award with the Loons. I asked him about what he saw on the streets in the aftermath of Floyd's death, including the protests that followed night after night in the streets of Minneapolis that have since erupted in all 50 states and over 40 countries across the world.
You know, I was out one of the early nights when, not the night that the precinct was burned down, but other buildings were being burned down, and the feeling that I had of, you know, walking amongst the people, honestly, there wasn't a part of me that was scared. I saw all kind of people out marching, and you know, whether you think it was right or wrong to burn down buildings or loot or whatever, you know, that's a different discussion. But for me, it was, you know, it was optimism in seeing that no longer, the people no longer wanted to be pushed aside.
Peace on the left!
in a weird, strange way, almost beautiful to see. A murder could have caused what would seemingly seem like chaos, but really was, you know, people who were frustrated and wanted to be heard after our voices and a lot of people's voices going on deaf ears for so long on so many issues.
This is a real war with the people. I ain't never seen some shit like this before in my life.
It is impossible to ignore the racial geography that in many ways has helped to create this violence, including at the intersection of Chicago Ave and East 38th Street, where George Floyd was killed. It is a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood where Black people are being displaced at varying degree of real violence and physical harm. And maybe even as a result of this, Minneapolis is often featured in various magazines and publications as one of the most livable cities in the country. But the question is clearly, for whom? Just consider this stat from the New York Times for a moment. Today, 76% of households headed by a white person own their home in Minneapolis, versus 24% in cases where the household's primary breadwinner is Black. Oh, and the Minneapolis police? They've used force against Black people at 7 times the rate of their white counterparts. So, these massive gaps, whether in housing, employment, police brutality, or educational opportunities, make Minneapolis, at least for the Black community as it relates to equality, statistically, one of the least livable cities in the United States, and well before the horrific murder of George Floyd. So, I reached out to Portland Timbers striker Jeremy Ibobasi, who since being drafted into MLS in 2017 from Duke University, has become well known for speaking out against racism and for criminal justice reform.
You can't ask why a lot of Black people live in certain neighborhoods without understanding how the government played a role in segregating those neighborhoods, how they played a role in redlining them in and out of neighborhoods, how they reverse redlined them at the turn of the century, while 30-year mortgages were made widely accessible and made homes affordable to white people, Black people were excluded from the same government programs. And so while white people in general were building generational wealth, Black people were facing generational debt. The historical parallels to today across industries are stark and need to be understood if we're gonna move forward in the way that we claim in this current moment that we want to.
When we look at police brutality and I guess policing on a national scale and from a historical perspective, how does this happen? What are the roots to this and how far back does this go?
When we talk about policing in Black communities especially, you can't separate what's going on today with the historical trend that started with, runaway slaves and fugitive slave laws, and then focused on, you know, getting Black people back onto the plantation system after the Civil War when slavery was ended, you know, vagrancy laws and the rest of the Black codes. And even if you look at the 13th Amendment, abolishes slavery, except in the case of punishment for a crime. You see that the legal system and the laws were put in a position to subjugate Black people, and they needed people to enforce these laws so that they could put Black people, quote unquote, back in their place. We've progressed, you know, there has been progress, but that lingers in the mind of the Black community, and frankly, that lingers in the mind of some police officers and police departments, that they're there to enforce the law in these communities, and it's an us versus them mentality. It's not always a protective mentality. My dad's from Cameroon. My mom's from Madagascar. They met in France, and that's where they had my brother and I. And so coming of age, I started to piece everything together on my own. And, you know, I had to unlearn a lot of things because not getting these stories passed down from generation to generation means that there's the possibility that you try to go your own path with your head down and not attributing any racism to racism. And I think that that's a dangerous risk that, you know, international black folk might go down. And it followed me everywhere from my quiet suburb to, you know, Duke, where we still see Confederate flags in certain dorm rooms. It's always there. It follows you around. You can't hide from it, no matter who you are.
Hearing your story is making me reflect a little bit on my own, and even looking at that disconnect part and learning about your history. I mean, I grew up in Berkeley. My mom's white, but my dad's Aboriginal Australian. And kind of like as I got older, I had learned more about the history of the treatment of Aboriginal people in Australia and from the founding of that country as well. And they would actually take the children away from their indigenous communities, starve them of their language, and they would become property of the state. And then even if you look at today, I see protests happening all across Australia and people out in the streets with Black Lives Matter, and 430 Aboriginal people died in custody over the last 30 years. I think I saw a stat that was like two have resulted in charges. I think the idea that people are marching here, but like the success of this movement here, if we like look at the history of movements, you know, has real material consequences for Black indigenous people around the world as well. So
yeah, I hear that. And the one thing that makes me hope a little more than, you know, I have in the past is the international outrage. That is how you dismantle at least the underlying pinnings of oppressive systems, whether we're talking about separate but equal, apartheid. These regimes don't topple over just because of domestic unrest. When we're talking about COVID, how it's disproportionately affecting communities of color, there was a scathing article in The Atlantic that said, once America realized that Black and brown people were disproportionately dying from the coronavirus, the pandemic all of a sudden became less important to the idea of opening back up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here in Georgia. I came down from Brooklyn, but came to Georgia. That seemed to open up right in. And then, yeah, I've heard the same thing where people say, look, the Black community is either dying from coronavirus or dying from police brutality, or in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, just going on a run, just trying to be healthy.
There's so many things. We're running out of ways to die at this point.
In the shadow of mourning, a man runs for pleasure. In 3 weeks' time, a virus will shut down his country, but he don't know that yet. He's making his heart work, breaking a sweat because the young man is alive.
This is my high school English teacher and soccer coach, Mark Bamuti Joseph, now vice president and artistic director of social impact at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts.
He is 25. He was born on a Sunday. He's wearing all white because it's fly. He's not going to no ceremony or whatever. His gear is bright as fuck. He has nothing to hide, running for his health. His country is sick. Symptomatic systemic violence, sadistic bigots, and a complicit network of badges and judges and a stunning lack of originality. Really, fellas, in Georgia, pickup trucks and rifles and lynching, the crude instruments soothing the cancerous hands, bloody racist trigger fingers itching, a man running for pleasure. American illness killed him while someone was filming. Three district attorneys have reviewed the case. The killer's still not in prison. You want to talk about a virus? You want to talk about contagion? You want to talk about something make you want to stay inside because you just might catch it when you step out your own front door on an arbitrary Tuesday, and you alone finding yourself fighting for your life. Hear something explode like a raisin in the sun, heart beating at the pace to meet the blood needs of your run, and suddenly you realize that you can't breathe. The disease was inevitable, but the fallout is preventable. We can't eliminate racism, but could we, America, cure ourselves of racial injustice? Justice for Ahmaud Arbery.
An injustice against one is an injustice against all. Today, I mourn the death of justice. Won't you mourn with me? Come on.
Now, here in Atlanta, where I've been staying throughout the quarantine, not only is it well represented, but in Metro Atlanta, it's over 50% Black. Known for its Black wealth, higher education like Morehouse, Clark Atlanta, and Spelman, and political power with all Black mayors since 1973. And you can see the cultural influences in the soccer here as well.
I grew up listening to hip-hop, and I love it. It's my passion in life after soccer.
This is Curtis Jenkins, president of the Atlanta United supporters group, Footy Mob. In a clip of our interview with him in 2017 outside the Dungeon in the Lakewood Heights neighborhood of Atlanta, where Outkast and Goody Mob recorded.
We hope the Atlanta-ness sort of comes through more than anything else, that it should feel authentic, that it shouldn't feel like any other supporters group in any other city.
So, being back in Atlanta, I hit up Curtis again to talk and asked him about his response to the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed 25-year-old Black man who was fatally shot on February 23rd in Glynn County, Georgia, while jogging. Video of the incident wasn't made public until early May, more than 2 months after his death. Up until then, no charges had been filed against the three men involved in Arbery's death.
Well, remember, they went through three district attorneys to even get charges. I mean, that's a horrifying indictment of our criminal justice system. And if it weren't for the fact that one of the people who's now indicted had the audacity, I guess is the best word, to video it and then leak it so he was like, hey, I wasn't involved, when it turns out he had hit him with his truck.
And just after my talk with Curtis, the murder of another Black man on June 12th, 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks, a father of four, shot twice in the back by Atlanta PD after responding to a call of a man asleep in his car in a Southeast Atlanta Wendy's parking lot, was a harsh reminder that these gross instances of racial injustice aren't really instances at all, or for that matter, just the problems of rural Georgia to deal with.
And I think that's been the hardest thing of the last few years, of not just these latest incidents, but all of them going back before cell phones, where our family sold us all these stories of like where you could go, where you shouldn't go. When I went to college, I was told don't go 3 miles literally past the college in one direction because there was a Klan house there. And I think that's the scariest part about it, is you avoid danger. Now danger's coming to find you.
Masses of people took to the streets in Atlanta after the murders of George Floyd and then Rayshard Brooks. So it would make sense then that after posting my own videos of being at protests from downtown to outside the governor's mansion, I received a number of DMs from Atlanta United supporters who'd been out in the streets as well and were eager to link up.
I mean, right now we live in two different worlds. There is the Atlanta that is out there in the streets protesting, screaming for help, demanding some kind of change. And then as you're marching down the street, the other Atlanta is right there watching you as they're eating brunch.
This is Najee, a member of the Atlanta United supporters group, Guerrilla Company, who during a typical MLS season might be painting signs or TIFO displays at Atlanta United games, but in 2020 was painting protest signs and fixing them on highly visible places, like on the day I visited, a black and white sign saying, "Your silence is deafening," fastened to the overpass on Highway I-20.
This is a support group founded on equality and treating everybody with respect. So of course, when the killing of George Floyd happened, immediately we jumped on it. We knew exactly what we wanted to do and say. So we immediately mobilized, we got together, threw some supplies together, you know, took change out of our pockets, whatever we could do, built a little banner, hung that up, and then that started it, where people saw it, and all of a sudden, as the protest grew and grew and grew, more people that wouldn't necessarily be involved have reached out saying, hey, how can we help? Whether it's through donations or how can I come out there with you? We don't know what to do. So we're trying to use our supporter group as a vehicle for good to help get more of the soccer scene that is a little more quiet involved and out there and showing support for their brothers and sisters that are unfortunately being gunned down in the streets.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you even just inviting me out here today and get a chance to see like what you guys are doing. Yeah, let's go hang this sign.
The coffee shop where they paint the signs is called Hodgepodge, over on Moreland Ave in East Atlanta.
I think we were the second, maybe third female-owned coffee shop in Atlanta. And I think we were the second Black-owned woman coffee shop in Atlanta.
And this is its owner, Crystal Rodriguez, also an Atlanta United supporter. Crystal told me that Hodgepodge, the name, is a nod to Atlanta's diversity.
The vast majority of, you know, coffee shops who have customers, especially customers that stay, are white males. There's just this assumption that, you know, there are some places that are safe for minorities to be and some places that just aren't really safe for minorities to be. I mean, just, what, 2 years ago, that one Black man who was waiting for his friends at Starbucks got called on by the management and arrested. Mm-hmm. So as much as it seems like it's not a thing, it's very much a thing. And it's very much a thing in the Black community.
I talked to her about what it's been like at the coffee shop since these series of videos have been released, and especially after the murder of Ahmaud.
I can tell you that I have not seen the video because I am not a fan of trauma porn. I really hate all of the videos of minorities being harassed and abused and murdered. I don't click on them. But I do think that it is important for the white community and other communities to see it and to understand how unprovoked, you know, some of these things can happen so that, you know, when people do try to make up these narratives about, oh, well, you know, well, maybe it was because of this or maybe this happened. And, you know, I can't imagine anybody doing that unless this happened. It is good for them to have literal footage for them to see that that's not always the narrative, and actually very rarely is that the narrative. Think about the number of Black people that have been killed by the police who, like, whose names we'll never know because there wasn't video of it, because there wasn't, you know, a Twitter feed about it. It's so systemic and it's so systematic that there's going to have to be a whole lot of unpacking and unlearning for everyone involved to not think that the immediate reaction to any sort of proposed or conceived infraction is violence. It just doesn't need to be that way.
Get out of this mess. Revolution, nothing less. How do we get out of this mess? Revolution, nothing less.
Just after midnight on March 13th, and more than 2 months before the death of George Floyd, a 26-year-old EMT named Breonna Taylor was killed by police while she was asleep in her apartment in Louisville, Kentucky. Three plainclothes Louisville police officers executed a no-knock search warrant to enter her apartment, where they shot Taylor after Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, fired towards what he says were unidentified intruders at her door. Mr. Walker told investigators that Ms. Taylor coughed and struggled to breathe for at least 5 minutes after she was shot. The Louisville Courier-Journal reported she received no medical attention for more than 20 minutes, citing dispatch logs, where she died there on the scene. The police were investigating two men who they believed were selling drugs out of a house that was far from Ms. Taylor's home, but claimed that one of the men had used Ms. Taylor's apartment to receive packages. No drugs were found in the apartment. On June 11th, the Louisville Metro Council voted unanimously to ban no-knock search warrants as a result of this case. One officer has been fired and two more have been placed on administrative reassignment. To date, though, there have been no arrests or charges filed against the officers involved. As we try to process the death of Breonna Taylor amidst the losses of Ahmaud Arbery, Rashard Brooks, George Floyd, and others, I spoke with my friend Charity Blackwell, a spoken word artist, host, and MC, and the Director of Creative Arts and Education for the Washington, D.C. chapter of America Scores, a national nonprofit organization focused on youth development through soccer and poetry. Here's Charity during a 2019 episode of The Movement.
We have kids who can tear up a soccer field, for sure. And we may as well have a mini Messi in our midst, but we might just have a mini Maya Angelou or a mini Langston Hughes.
Although it has begun to change, I spoke to Charity about why stories like Breonna Taylor's haven't seemed to capture the same attention in the media or in our collective consciousness.
When we're talking about Black Lives Matter, it seems that a lot of lives are not included in that. And that's exactly what we're fighting against. When we hear all lives matter, we don't like to hear that because it's like, no, because we're talking about Black lives. But even when we are talking about Black lives, we can't talk about Black lives and not include Black trans lives. Black queer lives, Black women lives. When we are coming together as a collective, when all of us are protesting, all of us are marching, especially how hard our Black women go for our Black men, everyone's story should be getting the same energy.
Not long after the death of Breonna Taylor, I received a DM from Ray Gaddis, the Philadelphia Union defender you heard from near the beginning of this episode. Ray is one of the more well-respected players and people in MLS. And in July, when the Union players shocked everyone, changing the names on the back of their kits to honor those who've lost their lives at the hands of the police, Ray chose Breonna Taylor's name to wear on the back of his kit. I called him afterwards while he was in Orlando to ask why.
And the whole reason why I chose Breonna Taylor is I'm African-American man. I have a mother who's Black. I have a wife who's Black. I have a sister who's Black. Oftentimes, we see a lot of African-American men who are at the forefront of police brutality and oppression, but we don't mention enough about the women who have gone through the same things. She was an outstanding citizen. She was an EMT. She was fighting the good fight. It's my obligation, my responsibility, my duty to also to speak up about the women who have been slain in America. Because when I look at the Black women in my family, they're very strong. But, you know, I just felt that I was responsible to also advocate for them as well.
The last few months have been tough for Ray. Back in the spring, he began sending me videos from his hometown of Indianapolis, where he'd gone while MLS was on hold. Ray attended a peaceful protest led by local faith leaders outside of the Indianapolis City Council building. There, Ray and other protesters participated in a die-in, where they laid on the ground for 8 minutes and 46 seconds in remembrance of George Floyd. I spoke to Ray while he was in Indianapolis. It was actually the night of George Floyd's funeral, where he watched at home amongst three generations of the Gaddis family.
As we laid on the ground, actually, for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, I thought about all the instances and that I have had to encounter. I thought about how precious life was. I thought about how I'm a husband, I'm a son, how I'm someone to someone. There are many thoughts. I thought about the solidarity and so many people standing up in my home city in Indianapolis for what's right, despite your color of your complexion. In spite of your background, I just thought that it was a very powerful moment in my city. It was stillness.
Like many players in the BPC, going to the protests and in their cities felt important. Ray sent me this video on the same day of the die-in of Minister James Coleman, in front of the city council building's front steps.
So all in all, I'm so glad to see all of your beautiful faces today, in all colors, shapes, sizes, and in different faiths. It's beautiful. This is what Martin was talking about.
I'll say it, as a white male in this country, I can't understand what certain people have gone through their entire life, what a person in Chester has gone through. So
this is my former teammate with the Chicago Fire and now head coach of the Philadelphia Union, Jim Curtin, in my interview with him 2 years ago now for the Movement episode we filmed in Chester, Pennsylvania, a predominantly Black neighborhood where the Union Stadium is. Jim has been one of the more vocal allies amongst coaches in MLS, using his platform as one of the league's longest tenured head coaches now to support his players and to work together towards social change. We met up at the neighborhood Jamaican spot, OB's in Chester.
I think the players deserve more of a voice. They're the ones that go through the day-to-day. I think it's your responsibility to shut up and listen and learn from those people that have experienced some hardships and try to make things better and have discussions.
After MLS play was halted in March due to the coronavirus pandemic, Ray was given the green light to leave Philadelphia and head back to Indianapolis, where his family was waiting. As it turned out, Ray's was one of many families of color in the United States directly and disproportionately affected by the pandemic. Ray lost his 84-year-old grandmother, Aletha Mae Darty, the matriarch of the Gaddis family.
This disease is real. This disease is something that will forever change, at least my life. To lose a loved one unexpectedly is unthinkable, I would say. Even attending a service where you don't really get to engage with your family members due to restriction, to have to go through trying to arrange a loved one's death. You know, some people are taking it too lax. Some people may have not thought that this was something that was real. And I'm just giving a firsthand witness that it is very, very real.
Before the union's opening match versus NYCFC, where Ray honored the memory of Breonna Taylor, MLS Works, MLS's charitable arm, had left a blank space for the MLS Unites initiative, where players were free to write their own message around social justice, honor first responders or heroes in the players' lives or communities. Ray wrote this message in black Sharpie to honor his grandmother and to call attention to the more than 3,000 lives lost to COVID-19 in Indiana alone. In loving memory of Aletha Mae Darty, COVID-19 is real. Love you, Grandma.
African Americans are in two pandemics. One with the COVID-19, as African Americans have been affected the most in the death total in America, but also a pandemic that was here before the COVID-19, and that's the pandemic of racism. So I think when you say I can't breathe, it says a lot of things. It says a lot of things in my mind.
This is Reverend Darian Bowie in the video Ray sent me from the Indianapolis City Council building's front steps.
I looked up the symptoms for COVID-19, and it says that it causes you to struggle breathing. And I can be reminded of what it feels like to be black in this country, to feel like the weight of oppression is on my chest in such a way that I can't breathe. I'm tired of going outside and feeling like I can't get fresh air. I'm tired of going to the mall and not knowing if I'm going to make it home. My soul is vexed because I want to have a child, but I do not want to bring him into this world not knowing if he will make it to see his first steps. We're tired, and that's why we're here today. We're wrestling with this pandemic, and it's time for us to take the necessary steps to make our needs known. These are our needs, and because they're our needs, we want everybody to know that these are non-negotiable. This is not up for discussion. This is not up for debate. This is not our opinion. This is our unalienable right to be here in this country. I thought about how it is to be black, and I'm reminded that we built this country. We live in this country, and because we stay here and we have families here, we deserve the same rights as everybody else.
The MLS's back tournament ended on August 11th, where Portland Timbers became the champions. And the MLS regular season resumed in Frisco, Texas, the following day. And sadly, the end result, a 0-0 draw between FC Dallas and Nashville SC, two teams that were withdrawn from the MLS's back tournament due to confirmed COVID cases on each team's roster, was overshadowed amidst the news that some of the fans at the game booed when players from both teams kneeled during the national anthem. Barely a month after this heightened awareness around the Black Lives Matter movement and the formation of the BPC, players were quickly reminded that the solidarity expressed almost uniformly amongst players and staff within the bubble, well, outside, was not a sentiment shared amongst some fans in all MLS markets.
I love our fans. I love this club. And I want to see the support that the league has given us, that everyone has given us from our fans.
This is 22-year-old FC Dallas homegrown defender Reggie Cannon, a member of the BPC and one of the country's most promising young players, just recently securing a transfer to Portuguese side Boa Vista, addressing the media and his own fans after the match.
You got fans booing you for people taking a stand for what they believe in when millions of other people support this cause, and we got fans booing us in our own stadium. How disgraceful is that? It's baffling to me. As a team, we try to give the best possible product on that field, and these last 6 months have been absolute hell for us. Absolute hell. Because we have to watch other people play soccer, and we're just sitting at home, unfortunately, contracting COVID from the unfortunate situations that we were put in. I was pissed. Everyone around me was pissed. Ryan Hollings said the first thing he said to me after we got up off the knee, he said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry for our fans." because we had someone chanting USA when they don't understand what kneeling means. They don't understand why we're kneeling. They can't see the reason. They just think we're the ignorant ones. And it's incredibly frustrating. I'm sorry to have this tone, but you have to call it for what it is.
Cannon actually received death threats for his post-match comments.
I'm now beginning to understand just the fear that is just way too consistent with people of color that shouldn't be there.
This is his fellow FC Dallas defender, Ryan Hollingshead, on his appearance on MLS's podcast, Extra Time. As a result of showing solidarity, Hollingshead has also received backlash online.
I can handle it. I'm a grown man. I have a good mentality. I can handle these threats. Throw all the threats you want at me. If it means I'm standing next to my brother, if it means Reggie gets one less threat because I got 100 more, I'll take that in a heartbeat. I'm a white privileged male, you know, who has been set up for success in every potential way my entire life. I can take a couple comments, you know what I mean?
There are two systems of justice in the United States. There's a white system and there's a black system. The black system ain't doing so well.
On Sunday, August 23rd, Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man and father of three in Kenosha, Wisconsin, was shot 7 times in the back while stepping away from officers with guns drawn and leaning into an SUV carrying his 3 young sons, ages 3, 5, and 8. Blake survived the shooting, although he has been paralyzed as a result. As of the release of this podcast, 2 officers have been placed on administrative leave, but again, no arrests have been made. 3 days later, on Wednesday, August 26th, the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks shocked the sporting world by deciding not to leave the locker room to play Game 5 of their NBA playoffs in their bubble while in Orlando.
We are calling for justice for Jacob Blake and demand the officers be held accountable.
This is Milwaukee Bucks guard George Hill on ESPN, reading a statement on behalf of his team when they finally decided to come out of the locker room and speak to the press.
For this to occur, it is imperative for the Wisconsin State Legislature to reconvene after months of inaction and take up meaningful measures to address issues of police accountability, brutality, and criminal justice reform. We encourage all citizens to educate themselves, take peaceful and responsible action, and remember to vote on November 3rd.
I reached out to Philadelphia Union midfielder Warren Craval, this time while he was back in Philly, to see how the BPC responded.
Shortly after, you know, conversations started, you know, popping up, you know, on our side of things. This was all text, just a large WhatsApp group. Players chimed in, players, you know, gave their perspective on it, players shared how they felt, and ultimately, you know, it resulted in players outside of the BPC asking, you know, leadership how they felt about it. You know, what is the right thing to do here? Should we be playing, you know, guys like Luis Robles from Miami, Sasha Question, you know, Dax, and, you know, these guys are reaching out to, you know, leaders like Justin Morrow, Jahlil Anibaba. That's how fast everything was happening. You saw the game scheduled for 30 minutes later. You know, we were able to kind of bring those to a halt.
You're seeing live images on an incredibly emotional evening. The game is not going to go ahead this evening. We'll keep you updated on our social media channels as to when this game will happen again. But for this evening, there will be no game.
This is FC Dallas defender Ryan Hollingshead on the conversation that night between himself, the FC Dallas players, and FC Dallas owner Dan Hunt in the lead-up to their game on the 26th, scheduled at 7:30 p.m. in Frisco, Texas, against the Colorado Rapids.
We had told Dan, we're not playing, we're boycotting this game, and Dan had responded by saying, okay, but I think we should play. Are you guys committed? Like, I think we should play. And we put our foot down again and said, yes, we understand what this means. And so he agreed and said, okay, then we're in it. All together, we're in it. We're out of this game. It's boycotted. I want to make one statement that he made and try to quote it verbatim because it was a really powerful statement. Guys, we've already lost season ticket members. We have sponsors already lined up to drop us. This is a business. We care to make money here, but I want you guys all to hear from me. This organization and my soul is not for sale. It is clear as a club, we need to stand against injustice. And so we're going to do that. And it was a really powerful message and showed how much Dan cares about this.
Unfortunately, not everyone in ownership was in support.
RSL owner Deloy Hansen gave an interview Thursday morning on the radio.
This is ESPN's Sebastian Salazar on what happened the next day.
The players clearly supported national issues, but it's very apparent that they didn't support our local community. There's a profound disappointment that the spirit that is Real was abandoned last night. Obviously, the importance of bringing community together during COVID was not respected. The disrespect was profound to me personally. It's taken a lot of wind out of my sails, what effort I want to put into recruiting players and building a great team.
Shortly thereafter, MLS launched an internal investigation into Hansen after multiple allegations of racial abuse surfaced, including by former RSL legend Andy Williams, who was quoted in an article by The Athletic and an interview with KSL Sports the following day. On August 31st, MLS announced Hansen had decided that he would begin a process to sell Utah Soccer Holdings, the entity that owns Real Salt Lake of MLS, Utah Royals FC of the NWSL, and the Real Monarchs in the USL. One thing remains clear, though. In sport or society, change does not come easy. Quite the opposite, in fact. This is Portland Timbers striker Jeremy Abobasi.
You talk about the progress of the civil rights movement and herald its leaders who, mind you, were hated at the time. The progress of the civil rights movement was evident, but it was largely undone because our country didn't want to sustain that moment, that resistance, that backlash. Just reminds us that we can't rest on progress. Progress has to be defended all the time. It's tiring, but maybe one day it'll just become normal and we'll just accept that we have to defend this.
So, what comes next? The BPC is already organized into a collective voice we've never seen before in the league's 25 years, pushing for change now and in the process, creating a seat at the table for young Black men in MLS for generations to come. From a league standpoint, supporting Black Lives Matter can't simply be a press statement, a hashtag, or even a podcast. It has to be more. Once again, this is from my conversation with Footy Mob president and Atlanta United supporter Curtis Jenkins.
Like we all know, every brand is releasing a statement. The sincerity of that statement is based on everything that that statement is not. It's, what did you do in 2006? Where were you in 2017? Where will you be in 2025? Are you coming around when you need a brown face, a minority face, an LGBTQ face to put on an ad campaign? Or are you around when there are no cameras there? Are you supportive when there's no material gain for you? That's how it works.
Once again, BPC board member and Minnesota United defender Ike Opara.
The Black voice has been lacking in so many areas amongst our league. Our Black players have been one of the biggest catalysts in helping improve this league from a product standpoint and a culture standpoint and from a societal standpoint. Being able to give back and set up an avenue for players to be a part of, give back, grow into roles that they might maybe not even thinking about, you know, I think would be special.
The Black Players for Change, by its choice in name and by its very existence, begs the question, just why we seem so insistent that the beautiful game is inherently so. Progress in sport, like society, it too must be defended. I called Philadelphia Union midfielder, and luckily my good friend, Warren Craval, one more time. After the protests that for the first time in league history stopped the matches and reflected on the end of what's been a long summer, where barely 2 months ago the BPC formed.
I just wonder, you know, how does this end? You know, will you be able to actually put this episode out? Will there be more names? Will there be more engagement? You know, how long can we keep this movement going? I think it's all very tiring on a lot of fronts, but ultimately what we want is to keep the engagement going because that's how change happens. We've kind of watched Black Lives Matter be popularized via social media and, you know, the catalyst for that being Black deaths, right? So it became, you know, abundantly clear that Black death matters, but Black life also needs to matter, and not just live, just, you know, being able to thrive. To me, you know, it's about shifting the conversation from sports, right? We've done so much, you know, over the past few months as far as, you know, highlighting these social justice initiatives. We made shirts, we sent out tweets, we started campaigns, and people still don't get it. So I think the question and the frustration from a lot of these athletes, including myself, is what will it take for people to get it?
Thanks to Michael Milberger and Kyle Green at MLS Digital for supporting this piece and the Movement Project from The Jump. Thank you to my producer, Nick Furshaw, for his incredible work to help craft these interviews spanning months now into the story you've now heard. Be sure to check out his podcast, Paternal. I'd like to say a special thank you to the Philadelphia Union's Ray Gattis and pay my respects to the Gattis family for their loss. Thank you, Ray, for DMing me in the first place and for being the catalyst for this story to start. To which I'd like to say thank you to Warren, Ike, Jeremy, Curtis, Najee, Crystal, and Charity for their honesty, trust, and time. And to Warren, who not only continued to pick up my phone calls, but also designed the artwork for this Movement podcast, which features photography by another former MLS player, Ethan White. The music you've heard in this episode is from Irv the Villain and T the Human. Make sure to check them out. And the spoken word piece you heard on Ahmaud Arbery is courtesy of my former English teacher and soccer coach, now at the Kennedy Center, Mark Bamuti-Joseph. And oh yeah, we'll be doing more of these episodes of The Movement, the podcast, hopefully soon. Until then, once and for all, after months of being down here, this is Kaylin Carr signing off from my studio, better known as my girlfriend Nicola's parents' basement in Atlanta, Georgia. I hope to see you all, maybe even in person, sometime soon.